Last week we began in our study of eschatology. And it's one of those big words, isn't it? So who knows what the word eschatology means? I think everyone, probably our kids will know. They have these things, and they have them under the belt, don't they? So it comes from two words, like so many of the words, like these ology words. So two Greek words. The one is eschatos. So eschatos is it meaning the last in a series or the end of the line. And then logos. You know what logos means? So logos means word, but it can also mean study. So it's the study of the last things. So that is what eschatology is. And so classically, what eschatology would include, it will include topics like what we did last week when Richard spoke about what happens to you when you die, but more especially the resurrection that's coming, the bodily resurrection. That's the one big topic. The second one is what we're covering tonight is Jesus' second coming. Jesus' second coming. Just by the way, sometimes we talk about Jesus' return, but people prefer, or the theologians prefer to talk about his second coming rather than his return, because return seems like he's going to come exactly the same way as he came the first time. But that's not going to be the case. And then the third big topic is the final judgment, which we will look at, God willing, next time. And then after that is what we call the eternal state. So those four topics are classically part of what we would consider eschatology. Now, since eschatology includes like big ticket items like that, it's actually important. It's very important because it speaks about the future as God reveals it to us in His Word. And for us who lived 2,000 years after it was first revealed, and the Bible completed, we sit in a situation that some of the things that pointed forward would have, to some extent, have happened. Some of them are happening as we live. And some of them, arguably the biggest ones, are yet to come. So eschatology is important because it tells us where history is headed. And yet many Christians avoid eschatology. Why is that? Because thoughts of final judgment and the end of the world is not something that people like to talk about. The other problem with eschatology is that it involves difficult Bible passages, which has caused debates and even fights among Christians. And it's awful when Christians fight. So we rather not fight and therefore not speak about what causes people to fight. And some of us may have had bad experiences, either because of those disagreements or because you might have been in a group that is so fixated on trying to analyze all the current events and see how they're fulfilling the obscurest of Bible prophecies. And it seems like it's all they want to talk about. While the practical day-to-day implications of those things are forgotten. So we shouldn't let fear, difficulty, or past experiences cause us from not talking about what God has revealed to us. Eschatology is an important part of Christian doctrine. And it is very central to our Christian hope. It reminds us that history is not random, but it is completely under God's control. And everything is steadily unfolding and working towards a climactic fulfillment in Christ. Jesus' second coming, for example, is a major motivator for Christian living. Is it not? I mean, it just keeps us sober. It keeps us focused. We know what's coming. It is like a beacon of help and of hope to the Christian life. Because Jesus is coming. We know He's coming. But before we dive into the depths, we will probably not go very deep. We just need to lay down a few principles when we come into the area of eschatology. Firstly, we need to acknowledge that it's not all easy. The Bible's teaching on the end times is rich, and sincere and devout Christians have come to different conclusions about how to make sense of it all. It's not nicely packaged all in one little place and spells it out. It's actually scattered throughout the Bible, and to integrate all of that is notoriously difficult. Therefore, when we come to it, we must be humble and charitable and not treat everyone who disagrees with us on the details as a heretic. Secondly, some of the teachings in eschatology is primary. And we need to be able to distinguish between what is actually primary in this whole conversation and what is secondary. And on the secondary matters, Christians may agree to disagree. That's fine. So what's primary? There are core doctrines that Orthodox Christians must agree, and in fact do agree on, even though their whole framework might not look the same. So what are the four core doctrines that we, as a church, certainly insist on? I'll march through them really quickly. But it's important that we say, listen, we're in good company. We agree on these things. So no one is a heretic, right? So now that relaxes us and we can say, okay, right, let's deal with the complexities. So what are the four? The first one is Jesus will return visibly, audibly, personally, physically, publicly, and unmistakably. He will come in all His power and glory as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and He will come to destroy His enemies, to reward His people, and to rule the nations. That is not up for dispute. Secondly, Jesus will bodily resurrect all the dead. He will give every single person an immortal body, some to dishonor and some to honor the righteous. We looked at that last week. Thirdly, God has appointed a day on which He will judge the world in righteousness by Jesus Christ. All people who have ever lived will appear before the judgment seat of Christ to give an account of their lives and to receive a reckoning for what they've done, whether good or bad. Fourthly, after Christ's return and the final judgment, God will make everything new. The elements will be burned up, the heavens and the earth will pass away, and God will create a new heaven and new earth where righteousness dwells. These are the primary eschatological truths that unite faithful Christians. Christ's return in glory, the resurrection of the dead, the judgment to come, and God will make all things new. But as to how exactly we integrate it and fill in the details and form a view or a framework, that, I would suggest, is secondary. As a church, we stand firmly on the primaries. At the same time, we allow freedom to hold different views, to discuss, even debate, different end-time frameworks provided. We do it with humility, gentleness, patience, tolerance, and love. Under no circumstances will we allow differences on such secondary and even matters indifferent to disrupt our unity. And within that framework we save, then we can share ideas. Right, but we will not compromise on the primaries. Having said that, let's go into the primary doctrine of the Lord's second coming. In the Bible, Jesus' second coming is referred to in many different ways. So it's actually difficult to count them all. Because sometimes he talks about his coming, then he has a different word for coming down, then it has his appearing, and then it has his revelation. And there's a host of Greek words that are all different, but they all describe this event. So in one way or another, the Bible refers to Jesus' second coming hundreds of times. Some say over 1,000 times. Given just the fact that it's mentioned so often, tells us it's not a side issue. God wants us to be certain of Jesus' return, to be often reminded of it, and to live in the light of the reality of it. The second coming is one of the main beacons of the Christian hope and the Christian life. When we look behind us in history, what do we see? We see the cross of Christ, don't we? And beyond, we see creation. But when we look ahead of us, what do we see? We see the coming Christ. And that helps us to stay the course. Now, while we know without a shadow of a doubt that Jesus is coming back, we do not know exactly when. This is what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. But concerning the day and hour, that's of Jesus' coming, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. This is remarkable, isn't it? Even though Jesus is God's divine Son, fully God, all-powerful, all-knowing, he says he doesn't know exactly when he will return. This isn't a limitation on his ability, but it's a profound act of submission to the Father's will. His Father would not have him know. He could know. If he thought about it, he would know. But he doesn't. And yet, despite the fact that only the Father knows, many throughout history have taken it upon themselves to declare the exact date of Jesus' return. The latest in a string of false predictions came from a certain prophet, Joshua Malaika, from my homeland, who claimed that he saw Jesus sitting on his throne and Jesus spoke to him loud and clear, "I am coming." On the 23rd and the 24th of September 2005, I will come back to earth. Which is very strange, since Jesus doesn't know the date. Nevertheless, the pastor's prediction went viral. In response, poor people sold their possessions, left their jobs, and wrote notes to their loved ones, expecting to be taken in the rapture. I would imagine now they have to write them different notes about why they haven't been taken in the rapture. But the result of this is that many are left disillusioned and disappointed. And unsurprisingly, this is just absolute feed for the skeptics and the scorners, and it makes Christianity a laughingstock. Yet another failed prophecy. Dear brothers and sisters, the time of Jesus' coming is a secret. It's locked away in the mind of God the Father. We will not know when it will happen until it happens. But before it happens, a number of things must first happen. In Matthew 24, Jesus was with his disciples on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the temple. And he told his disciples that not one stone will be left upon another. To which the disciples asked Jesus in verse 3, Matthew chapter 24, verse 3, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Note that the disciples are effectively asking Jesus how many questions? Two questions. When will these things be? I.e., when will the temple be destroyed? And secondly, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? That is, which events will signal Jesus' public appearance at the end of human history? Those are the two questions. Perhaps in the disciples' mind, these things would have all happened at the same time. But as history has proven, it's not the case. In Matthew chapter 24, verse 4 to 26, Jesus then goes on to answer the disciples' two questions. And as he goes along and you read through Matthew 24 and you go beyond that, what you find is that the focus shifts more and more away from the temple's destruction and more towards Jesus' return. And certainly when you hit chapter 25 with all of those parables. But what Jesus then does is he points out what I will put under five categories of signs before Jesus is coming. Let's zip through them, five of those. You might even know all five of them. You certainly, as I go through, you say, yeah, I know this. So the first one is deception. So Jesus talks a lot about deception. He warns that false messiahs and false prophets will come and deceive many. They will deceive, even if it was possible, the elect. And if anyone comes to us and says, "I am the Messiah. Look, here is the Messiah," or "there is the Messiah," Jesus says, "Don't believe it." Even if the person performs wonders and signs. So that's the first thing. Has there been deception? Absolutely. The second one is wars and natural disasters. We will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. Luke adds pestilence, terrors, and great signs from heaven. We can identify with that, can't we? The third one is persecution, apostasy, and great wickedness, which we throw in one basket. Jesus' followers will be hated for his name's sake, persecuted, put to death. Many will fall away from the faith. They will betray one another and hate one another, and this will even happen among friends and family. And because there will be so much lawlessness, people become completely desensitized and love will grow cold. We can identify with that. Fourthly, the spread of the gospel. Despite all the evil forces of deception, wickedness, and persecution, the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed through the whole world to all nations. The gospel will simply be unstoppable. Amazing. God will not stop at anything until the very last elect soul has heard and believed the gospel. Fifthly, and this is the last one, is the tribulation. Before Jesus is coming, there will be such great tribulation as has not been seen since the world's beginning, nor ever will be again. With the tribulation, people will flee for their lives. It will be so urgent that they will not have time to gather their belongings or even their necessities. They will be traumatized because of their adverse circumstances. They will be conflicted because everything will conflict with their convictions. It will be so unbearable that God will have to cut short the days for the sake of the elect. During the great tribulation, there will always also be what is called the abomination of desolations. And this is what the prophet Daniel spoke about. What is the abomination of desolations? So in the year 168 before Christ, the Syrian king Antiochus Epiphanes went into the temple in Jerusalem. He erected an altar there and he burned a pig. And then he prevented the Jews from worshiping God. Now Jesus takes this abomination and he applies it into the future. In the year 70 AD, the Roman commander Titus invaded Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. Some say, that's it. But there's something worse to come. Listen to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day, that's the day of the coming of the Lord, will not come unless the rebellion comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition or destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against God, against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes the seat, his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. The man of lawlessness will be Satan's agent with counterfeit power, signs and wonders. He will use every kind of deception to lead a great rebellion against God. In fact, he will defy God and he will present himself as God. And he will demand worship of people. From Daniel chapter 9 verse 27, it seems that he will rise to power and be revealed at the time that he makes a peace treaty for 7 years. And when he comes in the middle of that time, he brings out his true colors. And he starts with all his abominations. But when Jesus comes, he will destroy him with the breath of his mouth. Who is this man? John calls him the Antichrist. So before Jesus' second coming, there will be widespread deception, wars and disasters, persecution, apostasy, and wickedness, the global spread of the gospel, and the great tribulation with the rise of the Antichrist, who will lead a great satanic rebellion. Now, sure, these signs were also present to some extent before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. But I suggest there was merely a foretaste. Besides, and there's some who say all of these signs that we've just mentioned already happened and passed. It's called the preterist, and particularly the full preterist view. And they say all these prophecies about what will come in the end is history. I think it's a problematic view. Let me just point out some reasons why. Number one, the gospel certainly did not spread throughout all the world, reaching all nations by 70 AD. Now, the word nations there is not nations like countries, nations. It is every single ethnic group. That's not happened by 70 AD. Secondly, there's definitely been worse tribulations in the world since the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. I'm sure you can think of more greater, far more severe tribulations on earth. And there's also no evidence, historical evidence, that God cut the day short, which is something that will happen in the Great Tribulation. There's a number of other problems with that view. And if that's not enough, then what follows immediately after the signs proves that those signs have not yet reached their ultimate fulfillment. We can see those things happening, but when they will be fully done will then be the moment that what happens next. And what happens next? Immediately after those signs. Let's turn again to Matthew chapter 24, verse 29 to 30, which Matt read out to us. And I'm going to read it again because it's key to what we're talking about tonight. Now listen how it starts. It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its life, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with great power and glory. So what will happen immediately after those signs have been completed? Jesus' second coming. And when he comes, no one is going to wonder about that. The entire universe will feel it. The sun will go dark, the moon won't shine, the stars will fall, the heavens will shake, and the tribes of the earth will mourn. This is no private, secret, imaginative event. Jesus will come down on the clouds of heaven as he was taken up. But when he comes, he will come in all his power and great glory on a white horse with all his holy angels and the armies of heaven on horses. Now here's the thing. Every eye will see it. Even those who pierced him. And it will be as visible as lightning. It will be as obvious as vultures on a carcass. And everyone wouldn't just see it, they will hear it. There will be a loud trumpet call from heaven. This is the point, as we said earlier. Jesus' second coming will be visible, audible, personal, physical, public, and unmistakable. We've spoken about the signs of Jesus' second coming. We've spoken about his coming itself. Have we missed something? What about the resurrection and the rapture? Aren't these things associated with his second coming? They are. So we need to say something about them. And the key text is 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16 and 17, which Matt read out at the very beginning. Let's read it together and just comment on it. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. Here we are told that when Jesus personally comes down from heaven, two things will happen. Firstly, all believers who have already died will be raised from the dead. Their bodies will come from the grave. That is the time when their souls and their bodies will be reunited. They have been with the Lord in heaven, but now their bodies will be with them reunited. And their bodies will not be their old bodies, but they will receive new, glorious, immortal bodies like that of Jesus. And that's the first thing that will happen, or the one thing that will happen when Jesus comes. Secondly, it says that all believers who are on earth will be caught up with the resurrected saints to meet the Lord in the clouds and be with him forever. At that moment, those who are caught up or snatched away will also receive their glorious bodies. Now, the term comes from the Latin word raptura, which is the translation of the Greek word harpazo, meaning to be caught up or snatched away. Now, with a rapture, there are several differing views within the Christian faith. Just to make it interesting. Now, given the nature of the issue and the difficulties in interpretation, I think we can agree it's not a core biblical doctrine. The Bible doesn't talk about it very often. And so it is, I believe, a disputable matter, which means that sincere Christians may respectfully disagree. So what are the main views or the perspectives of the rapture? I think there are three, and let's go through them quickly. Perhaps by this time your brain is completely overloaded and this will just go over your head, but at least I can tick the box and say we have done it. So the first one is what we call the pre-tribulation rapture view. Now we know what the tribulation is, right? Is that time before Christ's return when things won't go very well on earth. So what the pre-tribulational rapture view says, the rapture will take place before the tribulation. And this view, in this view, it is a secret rapture in which God will take away all the believers from the earth. He will snatch them away. And then when Jesus comes, his second coming happens after the rapture, all of those believers will come with him. The support for this view is from the Lord's promise that he will deliver his people from wrath, 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 10 and 5 verse 9, and the hour of trial that's spoken of in the book of Revelation 3 verse 10. And those who hold the view says that when you read through Revelation, you hit chapter 6, notably the church is not there until chapter 18, which is just before Jesus' return, second coming. So that's the pre-tribulational rapture view. Then there's a mid-tribulational rapture view. So in this view, so the rapture is, the tribulation is meant to go for 7 years. When you get in the middle of that, that's when the Antichrist sticks out his head and starts with his shenanigans. And everything, all the wheels come off. And that's the time at which the Lord will rapture the church. The third view of the rapture is that it will take place after the tribulation. At the same time when Jesus' second coming happens. Support for this understanding is that Matthew chapter 24, verse 29 to 31, which is our key text that we've read out tonight, and 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16 and 17 are actually two parallel passages that describe Jesus' return as a visible, audible event, and at the same time is the rapture, or the ingathering of the believers. So that's the third view. So there you have it, different views about the rapture. I don't want to say pick and choose, but what you could do is search the scriptures and talk to people and pray about this and land where you land. I don't think it's going to make a difference as to what's actually going to happen. Is that right? So we don't have to get too uptight about this. But the Bible talks about it, and so we're going to be mature about it and try to figure out what it says without losing the big picture. So the most important thing for tonight is that we believe that Jesus will return visibly, audibly, personally, physically, publicly, and unmistakably. He will come in all His power as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Now, what will happen once He comes? God willing, that is next time's conversation. But there's another crucial thing, and that is that we don't just believe this, that we live in constant readiness in the light of it. We need to have our boots on. We need to be ready. And there are so many things in the Bible that teaches us to be ready. I'm not going to go through all of them. But remember, the Lord will come like a thief in the night. At an hour we don't expect. Now, whether that's going to be a rapture before, during, or after the tribulation, I don't know. But it probably doesn't matter. Because the thing that matters is, are we ready? And may God bless us as His people to be a ready people. May God bless His word to our hearts tonight.